are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. Ladies and gentlemen, I cannot tell you how excited I am. I mean, we've had this guy on once or twice before in the past, but I cannot tell you how excited I am to have him on for this particular reason. It is on the occasion of the release of his book, Chain of Title, How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud. Ladies and gentlemen, David Dayan. Welcome back to the program, David, and congratulations.
Thank you very much, Sam.
The book is great. And I have to say, I was surprised because it is written like a movie. At times, there is like there's some drama in here.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't want to, well, there were a few things. I mean, number one, I wanted to focus on ordinary people who were affected by the financial crisis most directly, and that's homeowners who were in foreclosure. I didn't want to do another financial crisis story, which there have been hundreds, about, you know, the bank executives or, you know, people at the top, regulators, administration officials, things like that. I just didn't want to do that. So that's number one. Number two, I wanted to be able to tell this story from the ground level, from their perspective, and not give you more information than they had. So I wanted to take you through their process of discovery of how they kind of figured out in their own cases that something was drastically wrong, and then how they reacted to that, how they decided, I'm not just going to fight my own case, but I'm going to look for patterns here, and I'm going to, you know, try to help others and try to expose this. And I felt like the best way to do that was to do it in sort of a narrative, what they call narrative nonfiction kind of format, where you follow them along and you're at their eye level for the entire enterprise. And I was fortunate in that these people, it wasn't just a story of people hovered over computers, you know, looking at documents on public record searches. They got out in the world. They met each other, and they held these foreclosure fraud happy hours. They went to events and protested. They you know, met with law enforcement officials. There was the stuff of a propulsive kind of drama there that, you know, might not have been if it was just bloggers sitting around a computer all day.
Yeah, I mean, and we should just to give a brief summary to people, the book is essentially following three different individuals who had their own somewhat unique but also sort of consistent story of sort of how they came to get into the home that they ultimately lost or was attempted by foreclosed on the banks, and how they sort of came to realize, like, hey, there's something horribly corrupt here. One woman, Lisa Epstein, was a cancer doctor, sort of like a nurse, sort of like she's sort of like hospice care, I guess, at one point. And a guy named Michael Redman, who was a car salesman. And a woman, Lynn, I don't know how to pronounce her last name.
Simoniak,
who was an insurance investigator. So, and I should say that kids seem to play a role. Whenever you have kids, that's when you end up getting yourself into a jam with the houses. That was the one thing that just sort of like struck me at one point. Let me ask you this. Did you set out how did this work in terms of, and I rarely ask process questions about this, but I'm interested in, because you're telling the story of both the real victims of this crisis, but also it happens to be these victims who go on to sort of sleuth out the answers here. Did you go in looking for those two angles, or were you looking for people who had been victimized by the process?
No, I knew I wanted to tell this story. I actually met these three individuals all the way back in 2010. There's actually a scene in the book that is the scene where I met them, and that's when the three of them, after they've exposed this all, where they go to Washington and they have a meeting with a bunch of other people, activists and writers and regular, you know, federal officials that were working on this. I was at that meeting, so that's where I met them, and they became sources of mine, and then I got to know them and wanted to tell their story. So that was really the origin of it. I knew that in telling their story, I would be able to do two things. Number one, I would be able to tell this story of just how homeowners were victimized in the foreclosure crisis, not just them personally, but through them, because they you know, had interactions with all these people who had all these very similar stories about their victimization. And I also was able in that to tell the story that I reported for a couple years, which was the fact that foreclosure fraud, which was the mass production of false documents in foreclosure cases all around the country by the millions, how that was exposed to the nation, and then how regulators and law enforcement officials reacted to that. So you have this sort of macro story about, you know, what ended up happening, which was this big settlement, and you have this micro story, which is these three people and how they tried to not only expose this but get some good outcomes, and how they fell short of that. So it was kind of telling those two stories at once. There's a great book called The Skies Belong to Us by Brendan Corner, which is a story about hijacking in the 70s. And he tells this macro story about how there were this like weekly hijackings in the 1970s, with a micro story about one particular hijacking that was this incredible case. That was definitely a model for what I wanted to do.
Mm. And I have to say, what struck me, I mean, you have been coming on this program for years, and we've very often talk about MERS, and also. Partly just out of coincidence, my father had told me about different sort of similar problems with what was going on in terms of real estate in Massachusetts, you know, deals where the banks would collude with the real estate brokers to sort of fabricate a higher price so that they could get a mortgage for more than people could afford, and then kick back some of the money. I mean, just sort of crazy stuff like that, that he
right.
was like,
right.
there's just stuff going on here that he just couldn't believe, and was running, you know, like literally like running away from this stuff. And that's the one thing that struck me, is that it's not just MERS was one of the one sort of like, just sort of almost systemized, you know,
yeah,
institutionalized.
That's what people latch on to. Yeah.
But there was so many other different frauds that were going on in the course of, like, it's amazing. There's almost like no part of the process, it seems to me, through on both ends of this thing, that don't look like they aren't just like small time hustles.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And they all played a role with one another. So when you had this housing bubble that was created because of this demand for more and more loans through securitization, the securitization was the packaging of these loans that were originated by the thousands. They're put into trusts, and they're sent out to investors as mortgage-backed securities all over the world. Now, you couldn't fuel that demand without starting to give loans to people that really shouldn't have had mortgage loans. And you couldn't tell your investors who are going to buy these mortgage loans that, yeah, the loans that we made here shouldn't have been given and aren't going to hold up. So that's one aspect of the fraud. Another aspect of the fraud is the way in which that all is structured with securitization, where you have to buy the loans from an originator and go through some processes of transferring those loans, eventually going to a trustee and putting them into a trust. And, you know, you have to break the law to do that. And what I mean is you have, you know, it was not going to be cost effective or time effective for them to grab every piece of documentation, to generate all the transfer documents that are supposed to be done through over 300 years of property law, to have them stored with a document custodian for the trustee, and to, you know, properly effectuate that process. It just wasn't, you wouldn't have been able to do securitization at that level if you followed the law. So that fraud was necessitated. And then, of course, when they go back and try to foreclose on people and they don't have the evidence to actually prove that they own the loan, they have to mock up the documents. So that part of the fraud is all. So this was all sort of symbiotic in many ways. All this fraud kind of played off one another, and it was the only way really to get this done, where you could have $1 trillion of loans securitized in 2005 and another trillion in 2006. The only way to do it was by breaking the law.
I mean, you know, the interesting thing too about it is it shows that there are, and this is, you know, there's a broader conceptual, you know, question about MERS that it shows like the unintended consequence. Because I don't know that anybody who said like we've got this system of chain of title that you have to file at the, you know, the county level, and it's pretty it's a pretty sort of relative to the other ways that we financialize our economy. It's a pretty slow moving process, right? That was the problem.
Right.
With,
it's a pen and paper system. And there's a reason that it's a pen and paper system, and it's because, you know, the ability to buy and sell property with the confidence that somebody else doesn't have a claim on it is not only the basis of contract law and the concept of privity, that the person you sign a contract with actually owns the thing, but it's the bulwark of capitalism. It's what separates developed from undeveloped countries, having this confidence that you can buy and sell property without somebody else having a claim on it. And that's why it's a slow system. It's a slow system for a very good reason. And it's a slow system because there are double checks and triple checks within the system. And what MERS is, just to explain it, is the mortgage industry decided that they didn't want to operate under that system, that they didn't want to pay the nominal fees to the county recording offices, and they didn't want to spend the time doing the actual pen and ink transfers when you send a mortgage from one entity to another. So they would say that the mortgage was sold from the originator, the person who sells you, issues you your mortgage, to MERS. Then it would go up into this private electronic database that thousands of people had access to. All the transfers would be made inside this MERS database, and if they ever had to do a foreclosure, they would spin back out an assignment from MERS on behalf of this originator over to whoever the entity is who wants to foreclose at that point. And so the recording office never saw all those transfers in the middle. They only saw that it went up to MERS and then it went down from MERS over to this foreclosing entity. And there are several problems with that. Number one, there just were so many people with access to the database and nobody with double checks that it was subject to far more human error than the public system that we collectively decided as citizens we wanted to have hundreds of years ago that was working just fine. There was a study done showing that only 30% of MERS loans had the ownership statistics matched within the MERS database and in the public records. There just was no relationship practically between what it said in MERS who owned the loan and what it said in the public records who owned the loan. So that was problem number one. Number two was that when they went to foreclose, it was just there were these very questionable legal foundations, whether MERS, a shell company with 60 employees that has no interest financially in the loan, could then foreclose in their name, which is what they initially tried to do, on behalf of a foreclosing entity. And they would try to say in the same case sometimes that they were the nominee. They were just the nominee of the lender. They had nothing to do with the lending. And that they had the legal title and had the legal right to foreclose. They would say that in the course of the same case sometimes. The third big problem is that none of this really mattered if you don't fund the trust. And what I mean is that when these things got into a trust and were sold as securities, there were very precise legal steps written out in the agreement signed by all parties that you would convey these mortgages, the wet ink signature on those mortgage assignments, into the trust within 90 days. And if that closed, you don't have a trust that's backed by mortgage security. You have non-mortgage backed securities at that point. You have mortgage securities backed by nothing. And that was very explicit. It was in New York trust law. There was no getting around it. And the banks simply neglected to do it. Nobody transferred the paper. Nobody got the paper to the trust. And they tried to create these after-the-fact fabricated documents to cover that all up, and using MERS as sort of a shield for that. And that was the ultimate problem that Lisa Epstein saw in her case. In her case, MERS made an assignment to the entity foreclosing on her, and that assignment was made in May of 2009, even though she was sued for foreclosure in February of 2009. So at the time she was being foreclosed on, the entity foreclosing on her, by their own evidence, didn't own the loan. So this is what we were dealing with. And when you combine this fact that all this evidence was being faked with the fact that mortgage servicing companies were driving homeowners into default and defaulting on people who had never missed a payment, then everybody is nobody is safe here.
Well, yeah,
from this possibility.
The thing that I've noticed over the years in terms of like just the narrow question of MERS is that it gets a lot of poo-pooing because of it's just a failed solution. Yeah, it's a technicality. But it seems to me that there's an unintended consequence, because I don't like, you know, like I was going with this, was that, you know, when we set up the way in which we record property and who owns these mortgages and who has the rights to this property, subject to this loan, there was probably not an intention to prevent the sort of the high frequency trading of these notes, right? And but it did prevent that. Like, I mean, it wasn't just a question of it's inconvenient. It doesn't allow for a business model that allows for what ultimately became very problematic about these trading.
Right.
And
right.
So,
and it, yeah.
So it's an unintended sort of like benefit that basically puts the brakes on this sort of like heavily financializing of this market.
Of the economy, yes. And you know, when the first recording law in the United States occurred, it was 1636. So there was obviously no understanding that this would be an impediment to the high-speed financialization of the mortgage industry and turning it over to Wall Street and allowing them to buy and sell mortgages. However, it did have that effect because we needed a fundamental understanding of who owned what, and that was fundamental to the underpinning of our society. And we made a public decision hundreds of years ago that this is going to be the way that we dealt with this. And there was no public debate on whether we should privatize that system. There was no legislative effort to say, well, we should just use MERS to make it easier to buy and sell loans by Wall Street entities. They just went ahead and did it.
It's like the functional equivalent of me just deciding, like, you know what, I'm going to hit the streets tomorrow and start issuing my own parking tickets, I'm just going to do it. Like, I'm starting to think, like, this is my neighborhood, and I'm going to issue parking tickets to people because it's not fair. It's not fair. I got an issue with it.
They took this private because it was inconvenient for them to do it any other way. And when they did that, they ran into all sorts of legal troubles that were evident in the fact that they had to produce these documents
right.
after the fact. They didn't do them very well. You know, what we get into is that they hired these third-party companies to recreate these documents after the fact, and they were terrible at it because they were under cost constraints themselves to produce millions of documents.
Well,
and so you saw individuals who were made the corporate officers, you know, the lowest paid vice presidents in history, I call it, there was one person available to sign, but they needed a lot of documents, so they would have six or seven people sign on behalf of that one person. And so you see the name Linda Green on mortgage documents written 15 different ways because they would just have random people sign the name Linda Green to all these documents. So there were massive forgeries in the system. There was backdating of the documents. So they tried to say that the document was executed in 2007, but it would have a notary stamp on it that showed that the notary wasn't a notary in 2007. They would forget to change the effective date on the documents so that the mortgage assignment was executed on 9/9/9999. They would forget to change the name of the assignee to the document, so they would assign mortgages over to an entity that was literally named Bogus Assignee. There was absolute chaos here, and it led to even worse circumstances because since this ownership was confused, nobody really knew who owned what loan. You would have situations where people were getting foreclosure notices on mortgages where they paid cash, or where they never missed a payment, or where they
owned
the house outright.
Let me just clarify this for people. And I should say, too, I mean, I just want people to contemplate the idea that there were businesses whose job it was to create fraudulent documents. Like, that was their
yes.
business.
That was their job.
That was their business. It's, you know, that's
one
and that's
the,
and that's
one a, of the one of the companies, a company called DocX, literally put out a price sheet. It was a menu for what document you needed and how much it would cost. And one of the things it said was recreate mortgage file. In other words, if you had none of the documents, if you had nothing on this particular property, you could recreate it. I believe it was $85.
Right.
And you could
and by recreate
the
they
entire
mean,
mortgage file.
By recreate, they mean create, right? Because
yes,
it never
exactly.
existed in the first place. I mean, and
exactly.
So you know, if just for instance, in terms of nobody knowing who owns the mortgage, the way that this played out was everybody, you know, Lisa Epstein goes through this when she's trying to sort of figure out how she's going to deal. Like it was interesting to me that everybody saw that they were about to have a problem, right? Or you know, both your at least two of your protagonists saw, I think it was both of them 9 months out for some reason, that they had calculated we can stay above water for 9 months, which means that we
right.
have the time to deal with this. So she goes and calls her mortgage the bank theoretically,
her
servicer.
Company, yeah.
They think they own the mortgage. It turns out they don't own the mortgage. She gets foreclosed by four or five different people down the chain. She can't even find out. Even the people who are foreclosing on her don't
right.
realize they own her mortgage. It's such
right.
a disaster.
She calls U.S. Bank. U.S. Bank was the name on her foreclosure document that it was foreclosing on her. And she had never heard of them, and they don't exist in Florida. She thought it was a fictitious name. Like U.S. Bank sounds like a bank in a movie.
Right.
It turns out there is a U.S. bank, but they were the trustee. So she had never sent them a mortgage payment. She had never dealt with them in any way. She called U.S. Bank, and they say, we don't know about Elise Epstein. She goes, but you're suing me to take my house. How do you not know who I am? And what she then learns is this entire business of buying and selling of mortgages, and the inability to keep track of ownership and the mocked up documents after the fact.
What I also found really interesting, I mean, I was telling you this on the phone before we picked up. I mean, this I was surprised because I just wasn't anticipating sort of a a story. I mean, there's a sort of like an Aaron Brockovich quality to this, and it's about, you know, these are real people who are suffering through things, and in some ways this becomes an obsession for them that mm-hmm. it also creates a havoc amongst their family.
Absolutely.
With that said, what I really loved about this is there were things that I have sort of had a vague understanding about, but I, you know, that I became much clearer to me, and like sort of how this happened. And I want you to talk about the development, I think it was, of CDOs, because it really captured to me what was driving so much of all of this financialization is not like a big scheme. It's generally just one guy figuring how they can overcome the obstacles. Like, it's a salesman, basically, figuring out how they can overcome the obstacles to selling something to somebody else by that person's, like, concerns. I mean, the quality of it to me reminds me of, like, the way that I built these offices here, where it's just like, I put this layer of duct tape on here, and this is attached to this, and when it's time to move, I realize, like, oh, my God, how could there be so much layered crap everywhere? And that's what this seems to be. Like, there's no grand scheme here. It's just one guy, somebody saying, like, I'm a little nervous about buying that security. Well, let me come up with a way that makes you less nervous. I mean,
right.
I mean, that,
right.
Discuss the development of the CDO in that way.
So that's kind of chapter two, and the one guy you're talking about is Lou Ranieri, and he ran the mortgage trading desk at Salomon Brothers. And if your listeners want a much longer and more detailed treatment of that, get Liar's Poker, which was Michael Lewis's first book from his time at Salomon Brothers, and it goes into the entire history of Lou Ranieri, who was this guy who ran the mortgage trading desk there, and he figured out how to create, turn mortgages into a tradable instrument, basically. He realized that the mortgage market was the largest market in the world. The U.S. residential housing market is the largest market in the world, and that Wall Street wanted to play in it, that they wanted a piece of it. And at that time, they didn't have a piece of it, because the only people that were had a secondary market that was trading mortgages were Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And they traded very safe, conforming 30-year fixed-rate mortgages. And there were laws really prohibiting private entities from doing that. And so he decided a couple things. Number one, he wanted to redesign the mortgage security into a CMO, a collateralized mortgage obligation. And in doing that, he created this system where people didn't have to take any more risk than they wanted. If they wanted a safe mortgage bond, they would get the senior tranche. So there were different levels of risk, which they called tranches. And there was the senior tranche, the mezzanine tranche, and the equity tranche. And the lower you went on that scale, the more risk you took that the monthly payment wouldn't come in and you would get shortchanged on your payment. But basically, when all the revenue came in, when all the monthly payments came in, the senior tranche would get paid out first, and then the mezzanine would get whatever was left. And then if there was leftover from that, the equity tranche would get what was left there. And so it allowed people to have sort of a defined sense of what they were getting. You would get a higher interest rate at the higher risk levels, but you would have more risk of getting repaid. So this meant that you didn't have to worry about, you know, whether that guy in Albuquerque, you know, whether he could afford his mortgage or not. All you had to worry about was that you were taking a certain level of risk and getting a certain level of interest for it. So he redesigned the mortgage security. And then what Ranieri did is he went about legalizing it. He got the law changed through the Reagan administration, through the Carter administration. He got the law changed so that you could trade these mortgage-backed securities on a mass scale in every state as long as you got a rating organization to bless them and say that they were highly rated.
It's so,
as long as you got that, anyone could buy them, including institutional investors like pension funds and sovereign wealth funds and things like that.
It's so insane because it's like literally like having a car dealership and knowing that like I've got 100 cars here and I have reason to believe that 15 of them will explode at one point during. But
right.
What we're going to do is
diversify the risk.
Well, yeah, but if I say to people like, look, I'm going to give you you're going to pay the super discounted rate. That means
right.
that there's a 1 in 2 chance you're going to get an exploded car
right.
or you can pay a premium rate and you'll get a car that won't explode. I mean,
and then what was crazier is that they could sell that senior tranche, no problem, because it was lower risk. They had problems selling the mezzanine and equity tranches. So here's what they did. They took back those lower tranches, and they made new securities based on that, retranching them and saying, this is a security made up of this other security, but the top tranche will get paid off first. So they turned crap into AAA rated senior mortgage bonds. And they did this over and over and over again. They would just sort of julienne these things and mash up the worst bits of the other securities that they couldn't sell and magically, you know, through alchemy, change them into good bits again.
Well, is that because that ratings in that situation become just relative? I mean, it's sort of like you're taking the cream is rising to the top. You skim that off and you take what's ever left and then you just wait for whatever barely rises to the top there. Is that basically it? Like it's all relative, the premium of the crap.
It was somewhat relative, and it was also the fact that the rating agencies are deeply corrupt and that they would rate anything because the business model was that the issuer paid for the rating. So, you know, you're not going to give a bank a bad rating on their structured product if it meant that you wouldn't get more things to rate later on down the line. And there's a scene in The Big Short, which basically says exactly that. So, you know, it was about corruption at the rating agencies. It was about the corruption of their compensation model, which is an interesting thing because you see that down the line here. That there was compensation models incentivized bad outcomes for people. That was certainly true with the rating agencies, and that was true with the mortgage servicing industry. So when all these mortgages were bought and sold and sent into bonds all over the country, somebody had to be the company that took the monthly payments and did day-to-day operations with the borrowers, and those are called mortgage servicing companies. And their compensation model lends towards foreclosure and lends towards putting people into default rather than helping people get through their loans. So this is a complete inversion of the old mortgage industry where the bank, the local community bank, held your loan, right. And if you got in trouble, it was in their interest to fix it so that you could stay in your house. Now we had a model where the risk was passed around like a hot potato all the way to, you know, somebody owns a piece of your loan in Norway and somebody owns it in Indiana. And there's a mortgage servicing company whose compensation is based on two things. One, the unpaid principal balance, they get a percentage of that on your loan. So they'll never cut your principal because that's cutting their own fee. Number two, it's based on whatever fees they can generate that they get to keep, and they actually get all those fees paid back if there's a foreclosure. So this creates an undeniable incentive to give late fees, to give default fees, to give management fees, and to put you into foreclosure because the mortgage servicing company gets paid off first in a foreclosure. So,
and they set up.
A lot to be said about these underlying mismatched incentives that produce bad outcomes for homeowners.
And it's clear from your story and the timeline and the different stages throughout this that those entities are not just waiting for their the homeowners to screw up. Right? Like they have.
No, they're pretty active.
They're actively trying to create roadblocks that would push people into situations
right.
where there's late fees. Go ahead.
It was called called servicer-driven default. And you saw it over and over again. Going back to the 80s, I mean, I tell this story about this guy, Nye Laval, who's this kind of mythical character who ran a sports marketing agency, was a pretty well-off guy, and got involved with this mortgage in the late 1980s and ended up going on a 10 to 12-year crusade trying to fight this foreclosure. And it was all based on that mortgage servicing company just dialing up fees. And continuing to bash this particular property with different fees. And he figured all this stuff out years and years, and he actually warned Fannie and Freddie. He became a shareholder in he would buy single shares of all these banking companies and Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and he would go to the shareholder meetings and tell them, there's something terrible happening, and what you're doing is absolutely fraudulent, and you need to fix your processes. And Fannie Mae actually checked it out, and they came up with this. They had an outside law firm look into his claims, and that law firm said, yeah, this guy's right. Everything he said is actually happening, but what they conclude is that they don't think homeowners will have the resources available to fight them, to fight foreclosure cases at a large enough scale for this to be cost-effective to fix. It was similar to like the Ford Pinto memo, where in the 70s, the Ford Pintos were exploding if you touched the bumper. And Ford said, well, rather than redesign the assembly line, we'll just pay people off one at a time, and that will be more cost effective for us as a corporation. That's essentially what Fannie Mae said. They saw all of this coming, and this outside law firm said it will be more cost effective for you to just pay off the few people that challenge their foreclosure cases than to actually fix the system. It's an incredible moment. And so this has been going on for decades. And the sad thing is it continues to this very day.
Yeah, you've got a piece up at The Intercept to that effect. So from a reform standpoint, I mean, and again, like there was so many instances where there's just like petty ripoff scam stuff. Like, you know, like half this stuff just sort of feels like, you know, like phishing, you know, scams that you would see online, just unbelievable.
Well, it's because every little company that was part of what I call in the book the Great Foreclosure Machine, every little part of it wanted to get their piece of the action.
Right.
And so you have these law firms, which were called foreclosure mills, because they would go through foreclosures like a sweater mill would knit sweaters or something. There were these companies that were subcontracted to do inspections on properties and to, quote-unquote, trash out abandoned properties, which they frequently got the address wrong and would trash out the wrong property of someone who had no problem with their loan, or they would trash out places that weren't abandoned yet. You had these companies that were contracted to deliver notice, like a summons of foreclosure to people who you know fell into this, and they would do a thing called sewer service where they would just throw it in the gutter, and they could do it a lot more quickly that way, and they also ensured that the individual had no idea that there was a foreclosure on their property. There were all these petty scams that did go on. And they continue to go on, really. But I want to make one thing clear, because we've talked about a lot of somewhat technical stuff here.
The book
this
is not
a story.
Like that.
The book is not like that. This is a story about people who are thrust into this extraordinary situation and what they do, and how they sacrifice everything else in their lives to expose this giant secret about what Wall Street has wrought, and they become successful to a degree in doing that, and the story is really about people who have no institutional knowledge or resources, and they go up against the most powerful institution in America, and they get on the brink of success. And the other question in the book is reckoning with why they weren't ultimately more successful, and why Washington and Wall Street sort of colluded at the end to make sure there were limited consequences for any of this, and what that means about our society, our justice system, our you know, the level of accountability in society and things like that. So it's really that kind of a book. The highly complex mortgage transactions are sort of off to one side.
Yes, and I apologize for focusing on that, but I have to say the way you presented it was really I found it incredibly digestible, that part of it. Let me ask you this about and this specifically is about Lisa and Michael, two of the protagonists. Do you think they have regrets? I mean, in terms of like just how deep they got into this, I mean, because it, relative to somebody who would have just said, screw it, and I'll just get, you know, I'll just lose what I shouldn't be losing at this point and just cut my losses because he can't fight City Hall.
Yeah, I don't think they regret the fact that they, in their small way, helped people. I mean, the fact that they now work for a local law firm in South Florida, trying to help homeowners fight foreclosure cases one at a time, tells me that they don't regret, the expertise that they gained and the work that they did. It was really as much about comforting and sort of caring for other people in foreclosure as it was about their own cases. It was about helping people, and I think they were really transformed by that. Particularly Michael Redman, who was someone who was not someone who would go out of his way to help others, I think, right, by his own admission, prior to this situation. The obsession that he had with this foreclosure fraud really changed sort of the person that he is in many ways. So, I don't think they regret it. I do think that they used to think that they would expose this and that somebody would step in, someone in authority, and come up with a reasonable solution that would punish the wrongdoers and create a sustainable way for people to stay in their homes. And I'm pretty certain that they don't think that anymore. And so that in turn, if that's a regret, then they have that.
All right, lastly, what was there anything that really shocked you? I mean, you went into this knowing a lot of the basic, or I mean, even more beyond the basic outlines of this. Was there anything that sort of shocked you over the course of writing the book?
One thing that did shock me was sort of the level of, when you're dealing with whistleblowers, they're sort of somewhat paranoid to begin with. I write in the preface that every whistleblower is sort of a little bit crazy. They see these conspiracies and things. What shocked me was the level to which that played out and things that were checkable that did actually happen. Lynn Simoniak, she had her car, robbed on her driveway. And they were rifling through stuff. She would hear clicks. I heard from all these people that they would hear clicks on the phone on the line as if someone else was listening into them. More foreclosure defense attorneys would tell me about their offices being ransacked. Lynn Simoniak was on a plane. This is one of the more interesting scenes in the book. She was coming back from talking to a U.S. attorney in, I believe, South Carolina. She was going back home to West Palm Beach, which is where the story takes place in Florida. And she's on this plane, and this is before she's ever filed a lawsuit against any bank or anything like that. And she's on the plane, and she's next to a guy, and she goes over to get the in-flight magazine, and the guy leans in and says, "You know what happens to people that sue banks?" And she said, "What?" And he said, "They end up dead." And he never talked to her again. And this was sort of confirmed that she told this at the time to a bunch of other people. She had not been a public figure in terms of publicly, presenting a case anywhere at this point. She had just been talking to federal law enforcement officials at this point, so it's unclear how anyone would even know that she was preparing to sue Banks, let alone was doing so. And so that was really, really kind of made me uneasy when I was going into this. And I didn't know a lot of that stuff.
Hmm. Interesting. Yeah, there was you didn't experience any of that, did you?
No, not personally. But, you know, I mean, it did spill out. There's a very mysterious suicide in this book by one of the key witnesses, a low-level employee that used to forge documents, in mortgage documents in cases. There's some bizarre stuff in here that goes beyond just sort of the usual kind of lobbying and cover-ups that you might see in other corporate crime cases.
The book is Chain of Title, How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud. It really does read like a novel. David, it's a great accomplishment. I'm very happy for you. And I know it's going to be successful. I've already won an award. It won an award before it even came out.
Well, that was the publisher gave that award, but it's the Studs and Ida Terkel Prize, and I'm humbled by being put in the same category as Studs Terkel, as someone I admired. I should say I'm also if anyone's in Los Angeles, I'm actually speaking tonight about Chain of Title at the West LA Democratic Club, which is it's at St. Bede's Episcopal Church in Mar Vista. On Grandview Boulevard, and you can sort of look that up for the details. I have a Facebook page for the book, and all the details are there.
We'll link
it's
on that.
It's facebook.com/chainoftitlebook.
And that's where people can find out, like, where your other speaking?
Right.
Okay.
That's correct. I'll be in D.C., I'll be in San Francisco, I'll be in New York, Philadelphia, and St. Louis, and that's so far.
All right, folks. Can't recommend the book highly enough. David Dayan, thanks so much for coming on.
All right. Thanks a lot.